from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. In their rereading of Shakespeare's Hamlet, philosophy professor Simon Critchley and psychoanalyst Jameson Webster examine the play alongside writers and philosophers such as Lacan, Freud, Nietzsche, and Melville. The result, their book, Stay Illusion, a cultural and psychological analysis of the famous play, which reminds us why it has endured. They'll join us in the studio for the hour ahead, and you can join us as well right after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of the Forum program. Hamlet may well remain the most discussed and puzzled over of Shakespeare's plays, and certainly literary and Shakespearean scholars and critics have for centuries grappled with the play's meaning and its protagonists procrastinating and agonizing. Now, two admittedly non-Shakespeareans have written a book on the play from a philosophical and psychoanalytic perspective. Philosopher Simon Critchley and his wife, psychoanalyst Jameson Webster, have published Stay Illusion, a brew of Walter Benjamin, Carl Schmitt, Hegel, Nietzsche, Freud, Lacan, Melville, and Joyce, and their own analysis and interpretations of one of the most enduring and widely studied works of literature in the English language. They both join us in studio. We welcome you, too. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael.
Well, you know, there's an Elizabethan word that some of you may recognize called chutzpah that, to go on write about Hamlet when there has been so much written about Hamlet, particularly by scholars, by Elizabethans, by what they now call postmodernists and all that arguing over whether there's an objective correlative or not by literary folks like myself. Why'd you tackle it? Why'd you decide to do it?
I feel like it was completely naive. Literally, when it went into publication, I thought, oh my God, what have we done? And I was in a state of terror as to what was going to come back our way.
Well, what you've done is a pretty good book, actually.
Thank you very much.
Kudos on
Thank
that.
Thank you very much.
But, I mean, you've put together your combined erudition and reflections philosophically and psychoanalytically, but you've also honed in on a lot of opinions that normally aren't associated with Hamlet. I mean, we think of Harold Bloom and Stephen Greenblatt, right. And, you know, those big names, not necessarily Nietzsche or Hegel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's very intimate because we wrote it together and we didn't write it with a view to it being published. We thought it might get published in a little art press somewhere in a corner somewhere in 20 or so copies, and we didn't expect it to be picked up by someone like Random House and Pantheon. So it's also very hard for us to read because it feels like a kind of intimate journal between the two of us. So it's all the record of what we were doing for a year and a half in our house.
But you managed to bring the readers into this and bring them into just so much of what really compels readers to Hamlet.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And has for centuries. And let's talk about that, because
right.
A lot of it, from your perspective, has to do with, well, thought versus deed. I mean, and the chasm between those two.
Absolutely. I think it was, you know, Freud who sort of honed in on the fact that the Oedipus complex is something that we don't see. It's not as if we're walking around sleeping with our parents or killing them, but that what we see in Hamlet is the effects of the inhibition of desire, and it's precisely the gap between thought and action, or between desire and action, that you can see in Hamlet. You see someone who sort of can't fulfill what he needs to fulfill. And I think that that's why it was such a rich playground for psychoanalysis, was to say, you know, let's look at inhibition, let's look at repression, let's look at the way that these things sort of affect us on a day-to-day level.
But let's also look at the fact that he seems to be so compelled by the sexuality of his mother Gertrude, which,
absolutely,
you know, is
completely
at the heart of the play, because this is incest, sleeping mm-hmm. with, now she's married to Claudius, his uncle, and that was considered in that day to be incest.
Incest. Mm-hmm.
He gets very close to that. You know, the central scene of the play is the scene with the mother and the kind of violent intensity of that. And he gets, you know, and Claudius has taken his place in a way. So he's given an instruction by his dead father to revenge him. And he's constantly perplexed as to what his mother once.
But then there's that whole question, is it his dead father? I mean, it may be a spectral or poltergeist of some kind that may be hallucinated. Or
he doesn't know whether to believe the ghost.
Yeah, there's the soliloquy at the end of Act Two about theatre, where he concocts the idea of the play within the play to catch the conscience of the king because the ghost may be a devil. Right, so he even doubts the ghost. So one of the things that we look at in the book is doubt and what kind of thing doubt is. And Hamlet takes doubt the whole way. He doubts love. He doubts everything.
Freud has that wonderful statement in at the end of Notes on a Case of Obsessional Neurosis, where he says, a man who doubts his own love must, or rather may, doubt every other thing in his life.
Yeah, doubt is at the at the cornerstone of much of your writing here, as is shame. I mean, central, really, to what you've put forward here, and rashness. I mean, if we're looking for kind of key words like ripeness is all in Lear or something, we've got rashness, we've got
rashness
shame.
Rashness is all.
But there's also, you know, the sense that Hamlet is a pretty dark character in many ways. I mean, and so many have identified with him. He's had this great universality, despite the fact that he's misogynistic, misanthropic, kind of juvenile in many ways. You know, you don't read Hamlet the same way when you're 16 as you do when you're 40. And you're caught up in his emotions in spite of the fact that so much of the play, as you point out, is just inaction.
Yeah, I mean, we identify with him, we're drawn into him. But at the same time, there is something monstrous about Hamlet. There is something cruel about him. And what people always forget about Hamlet is what's there on the frontispiece of the play. He's a prince. And he's a prince with political ambition and political expectation. And that doesn't make him an ordinary person.
And a warrior prince at that.
Indeed.
Who can't seem to act as a warrior should act. You think about this play in light of something like Thomas Kidd's Spanish Tragedy, and you think about a revenge play as having blood all over. And, of course, Hamlet ultimately does. When Fortinbras comes in, there are a lot of carcasses there and everything. But it takes a while to get there. A lot of posturing and a lot of wit and a lot of punning and a lot of cruelty, as you say.
Yeah, it's Shakespeare's longest play. Hamlet is the character with the most lines. And, you know, a revenge play was a convention, and there was going to be a bloodbath. There would be a sort of Tarantino-esque sword fight, maybe in the middle, but certainly at the end, and a pile of bodies. And how do we get there? And, you know, the perplexing thing about Hamlet, it is a revenge play, but about the inability to revenge. And that inability to revenge goes on and on and on in the soliloquies. So what is also perplexing about it is what a success it was, right? It's a revenge play where the revenge is drawn out until
Five minutes of the play.
Yeah. Although in certain cultures it hasn't had quite as much. I mean, France, it's not been all that big, has it, historically, as I recall?
The French reception of Hamlet?
Yeah.
Well, one of the major interpreters in the book is Jacques Lacan, so he's French, and he certainly took the play up, and it was very, very important to his analysis. And I think he wanted to sort of shove it into the center of psychoanalysis because he was interested in the idea of mourning and melancholia in Freud and sort of bringing that back to the center. And for him, I think that's where we saw the real monstrousness of Hamlet. Was his interpretation of Hamlet is that he suffers from a kind of failed mourning, that it's the violence of a kind of narcissistic, melancholic inhibition. And to see him as a figure who not only cannot act, but then who lashes out against everyone around him. And someone who's, you know, really on the sort of precipice, that he can't cross a certain threshold, he can't get beyond himself. And I think at one point Lacan says something like, he is a coward through and through. And, you know, it's that rubbing up against the fact that we want to identify with Hamlet so much. We want to see him as this character who has this sort of amazing interiority, this, you know, his punning language and his sort of verbal abilities. But it's the other side of that we also really sort of want to shove into the center of the book.
We're talking to co-authors Jameson Webster and Simon Critchley, who have written a book about Hamlet. Called Stay Illusion, The Hamlet Doctrine. I was in Stratford-on-Avon just a couple weeks ago, and here I was reading, thinking about your book and reading it when I got back and thinking, what are we to make of the fact that Shakespeare had a son named Hamlet? Mm. I mean, talk about Lacan. He did all kinds of things with transliterations of letters and so forth.
And
there's an L to an N or an N to an L. And
yeah,
I mean, psychoanalysis would have a field day with that, I would think.
Yeah. So this is a play with the name of the dead son. or almost the name of the dead son. There are some sources which say Hamlet rather than Hamnet, but there were Shakespeare with Anne Hathaway had twins, and the boy died when he was about 10 in 1596. So there's that. There's also a famous drowning near Stratford of Catherine Hamlet, which was kind of a local news story. And Shakespeare certainly knew about that. And then also the death of his father a year, maybe a couple of years before the production of Hamlet.
Speaking of drownings, now you two take a position, as I said in my introduction, or actually in the billboard of the program, that Ophelia may be the real heroine of this play, or certainly the source that we identify with love. But she's mad, of course.
She's mad, and Hamlet.
But we question whether, you know, there's something very, very real about her madness, and in her madness, she still stays true to her desire for Hamlet. I mean, she's grief-stricken, not only for her father, but for the loss of her lover. Whereas with Hamlet, he drops his love for her, right? I loved you once, I love you not. And it's a sort of cruelty that we see him unleash at her that...
Get thee to a nunnery.
Go. So Hamlet, when he becomes mad and he puts on his antic disposition, then we get a report from Ophelia of what he's up to in her chamber. And that's a difficult scene to interpret. And then we find the mad Hamlet. And then he says when he finally confronts Ophelia, when Ophelia is sent out as bait to try and catch him, and Polonius and Claudius are hiding behind the scenes, he says to her, I loved you once, you know, I love you not. So in a sense, Hamlet's madness or his antic disposition, his feigned madness, is at the cost of his love. Whereas Ophelia's madness, as it were, is a kind of madness of love, and which is expressed not in soliloquies, but in song
and in flowers.
The extraordinary thing about Ophelia is that she bursts into these very, very sexual songs. Very, very sexual songs. Very saucy.
And by the way, Freud said falling in love is a form of madness.
It is.
Insanity, I think he called it, in fact.
And also very close to mourning, to the extent that he says it's the one time that our ego is eclipsed by the object.
And speaking of objects, I mean, when you talk about the plays, the thing wherein I'll catch the conscience of the king, it's almost as if Shakespeare is leading us toward understanding the illusion of the play as a way of understanding what we would call real.
This is theater as, you know, what we call meta-theater.
Self-reflexive meta-theater.
Yeah, completely self-reflexive. It's extraordinary that, you know, you began by talking about the gap between thought and deed, which is indeed true. And the closest Hamlet gets to bridging that gap is through theater, through the play within the play that will catch the conscience of the king. That will be an act of thought and deed that will try and unify the two. And then we find Hamlet not just setting up the conceit of the mouse trap, but also then commenting on the nature of theater and then giving advice to his actors on how to act. Don't overdo it. Stay within the modesty of nature and all of that.
Which is the same advice that he gives to his mother.
That's right.
That's right.
So it's the most, you know, it's the most, you know, exquisitely self-conscious play. So people think that reflexivity was invented in 1978 or
postmodernism,
so, whatever, you know, and it's nonsense. I mean, Shakespeare is the most reflexive, self-conscious, fictively self-aware drama you could imagine. I mean,
also, maybe as you touch on, particularly when you bring up figures like Nietzsche, it may be a nihilistic play. I mean, I think about I always thought about nothing will come of nothing in Lear and all of that sense of nothingness and so forth. It wasn't Beckett who led us into that world. It really was Shakespeare.
Absolutely.
The king is a thing of nothing. We make a lot out of that line in particular, the idea that he's, it's pure treason, but it's also Hamlet's sort of hunt for nothing. He's trying to get his hands around the nothing and to wrestle with it. And it's also why the title of the book, Stay Illusion, is so important, because it's not that we want to read this as a nihilist drama, but that we want to bring back the importance of illusion, whether it's the illusion of theater or the illusion of love, and how precarious illusion is. You know, as a psychoanalyst, I think of myself as someone who deals with illusion. I deal with fantasies. I deal with dreams. And it's not about getting beyond those to reality, but what it means to sort of get your hands around that nothing.
Talking again with Drs. Jameson Webster and Simon Critchley, and their book is called Stay Illusion, The Hamlet Doctrine. Boy, one of the things that was fascinating in reading your book was the idea of, Hamlet is a representation of a surveillance state. I mean, the Stasi or North Korea or what. I mean, there's what I think Shakespeare calls the hidden imposthume, you know, that idea that something is rotten in Denmark, like something was rotten in Thebes and it has to be expelled and exorcised, whatever. But also everybody's kind of spying, whether it's Rosencrantz and Guildenstern or whether it's Polonius, everybody's watching each other as, you know, we're very much in that world now, of course, with the internet, but there
That's
it is.
That's right. This is a kind of Edward Snowden-esque play, in many ways, Hamlet. It's a drama of surveillance in a police state, which is the police state of Elsinore, which is a state which is ready for war, which expects a foreign invasion from Norway at any time. And it's a kind of allegory of the police state that was Elizabethan England, which was a police state run by spies. I mean, we think of Elizabethan England as kind of merry England with people, I don't know, eating scones and sort of, you know, having parties. This was an authoritarian, centrally organized state. Very efficient, and it worked through a spy system. It was more like sort of East Germany.
It suggests maybe a kind of subversive leitmotif, or at least something to deconstruct that's subversive in Hamlet, doesn't it?
Well, yeah,
the idea of espionage is all over the place in Shakespeare.
I found this little quote from Heiner Müller, who was an East German dramatist, and his version of Hamlet, which was called Hamlet Machine, and it speaks to the sort of Snowden-esque aspect of the play. He says, this is Hamlet speaking, "In the solitude of airports, I breathe again. I am a privileged person. My disgust is a privilege protected by torture, barbed wire, prisons."
A lot of this comes from Carl Schmitt, who was a Nazi, basically, like Heidegger.
Basically a Nazi, that's right.
Yes.
But who offered some worthwhile analysis, I guess, one could say, in terms of this understanding this, as he was able to, perhaps from that perspective. There's a bit of a heretical view or two in here, to be sure. One of them is of Horatio, I mean, the loyal, noble, wonderful liege and friend of best friend of Hamlet's. You don't necessarily see him that way.
No, we see Horatio as a potential spy for Fortinbras. We see him as one way of reading the play, and we do this, you know, line by line, word by word, is to see Horatio as basically setting Hamlet up, because Hamlet's death is also when he gives his voice to Fortinbras. The election lights on Fortinbras, the rest is silence. So the play, people, you know, think Hamlet ends with a pile of bodies. There's a pile of bodies for sure. Then Fortinbras, it ends with a foreign occupation. And Fortinbras assumes leadership.
But order is restored.
Yeah, and Horatio is the ally of Fortinbras. He's there to tell the story of Hamlet, and to tell the story of Hamlet in order to legitimate Fortinbras' occupation of Denmark. So this is a drama of occupation.
And to control the masses.
Yeah, and to control the masses. A constant worry in the play, which is also a worry that was the worry constantly about London, is about the unruly rabble.
But as I said, order was restored. I mean, just we were talking the first hour about Egypt, and the military has come in, and now order has been restored. But, of course, there's all of these carcasses across the landscape, alas, and all this carnage. Mm-hmm. You also see Polonius is somewhat of a different figure, too. I mean, not that he's necessarily all that admirable a figure to begin with, but he's certainly often seen as a kind of font of wisdom, you know, neither a borrower nor a lender be, and all of these kinds
of... Let himself be true.
Yeah.
We call him the bad psychoanalyst in the play who only speaks in the language of clichés and self-serving interpretations.
Other than that, there's a great nobility to his character.
Also, he's a kind of spy master. He's a spy master general.
That's right.
He really is, you know, he's the sort of minister of propaganda in Elsinore. He's running the spy system. And an extraordinary moment in the play is when he sends off Laertes to thou know yourself be true, neither a borrower nor a lender be, you know, and off goes Laertes back to Paris to be a student. And then a couple of scenes further on, we find Polonius with a spy, Reinaldo, who he's sending to follow Laertes to Paris, not just to watch him, but to tell all sorts of horrible stories about him to find out what he's up to. So,
to use the bait of falsehood to catch the carp of truth.
To use the bait of falsehood to catch the carp of truth.
And by the way, the most famous New Yorker cartoon, which I always loved, was a guy going up to a well-heeled gentleman on Broadway and saying, asking for some money. Do you have spare change? And he says, neither a borrower nor a lender be Shakespeare. And the man responds by saying, blank you, David Mamet. Actually, let me invite those of you listening. We're having this rather intense discussion about Hamlet, and many of you have strong feelings about it, have studied it, have read it, have seen it performed. What particularly endures for you in that play, and what was especially perhaps of impact either on your consciousness or in your heart, your mind, and what remains of great interest to you about Hamlet? I'd like to just open things up and invite listeners into this conversation, and you can join us now at our toll-free number. Let's make it available to you. It's 866-733-6786. We continue our discussion with Dr. Jameson Webster and Dr. Simon Critchley, representing psychoanalysis and philosophy and much else in a book on Hamlet called Stay Illusion, The Hamlet Doctrine. You can join us now, toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us your thoughts or any questions or comments you might have. Our email address, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And, of course, you can tweet us, our Twitter handle, @KQEDForum. So what do you make of the graveyard scene, the Memento Mori scene and the gravedigger, from your perspective? I mean, it's such a central scene for many people and so much in the hallmark of memory with Hamlet.
Well, it shows that, I mean, one of the themes in the book is disgust. We try and talk about disgust at different levels and what it is that might disgust Hamlet. And certainly skulls don't disgust Hamlet. Mm. Hamlet is very happy with the skull of Yorick. He makes a series of gags about it. You know, it's nostalgic and sentimental, but it's a very, very dark comedy, that scene. You know, that is the scene which in many ways prefigures Beckett's Godot and much else by Beckett. You know, it's that scene of the... Yeah, born astride a grave and all the rest of it in Godot. So there's a sort of bleak comedy in that scene, certainly for us.
I think we sort of push past that scene and we're interested in what takes place shortly after in the scene where he confronts the dead Ophelia. And what's interesting to us about that scene is that it's the one time that we hear Hamlet mourn for her. Indeed, that we hear a voice of mourning in him when he says, I loved her more than 40,000 brothers ever loved a woman. And he also says his own name. It is I, Hamlet the Dane, which is obviously Hamlet. Very important for psychoanalysis that he assumes the name, and it's also the name of the father. You know, and of course, we're very interested in the interpreters like Harold Bloom, who says that, you know, Hamlet comes back in Act 5, a kind of resurrected, changed man. And we say maybe for a second. But right after that scene with Ophelia, he sort of leaps at Laertes and in a sort of wild, manic rage says, you know, what would thou do for her? I would eat a crocodile. I'd drink Isil. And then he says, and you use me thus? So we talk about the fact that he kind of drops Ophelia again and enters into a kind of homoerotic rivalry, you know, with these sort of mirror figures.
The only time he can express his love for Ophelia is when Ophelia is dead.
Yeah.
And in a kind of rivalry with the brother.
So this is a play to you that's all about melancholy and mother desire.
Yeah.
But also mourning, and mourning to the point, as you say, between narcissism and desire.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
As a kind of switch point, you know, which direction are you going to go? Are you going to go towards melancholia, or are you going to go towards acknowledging what it is that you've loved and what you've lost?
It's also a play that brings us right into, and again, like I said, I was mindful of this when I was in Stratford, the constant arguing that goes on about, was Shakespeare a Catholic? Was he a Protestant? I mean, may never be resolved, of course, and I think the majority are with the Protestantism, but nevertheless, you know, just the whole role of ghosts in different views theologically play into any interpretation.
The theology of Hamlet. It's amazing because obviously what's happening, you know, in England at this time is the transition from the old world of the Catholic order to a newly emergent Protestantism. And Hamlet is a student in Wittenberg, the centre of the Protestant Reformation. He's not just a student anywhere.
And that's where Luther posted them. We are coming on a break. We'll be back and we'll hear your thoughts about Hamlet. Join us toll free at 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. In their rereading of Shakespeare's Hamlet, philosophy professor Simon Critchley and psychoanalyst Jameson Webster examine the play alongside writers, philosophers, Lacan, Freud, Melville, Joyce, and the result is Stay Illusion, a book about the cultural and psychological analysis of the famous play, which reminds us among other things, why it has endured. And you may want to talk about why the play has endured for you, or perhaps in some instances why maybe it hasn't endured. We welcome your phone calls and your involvement in the program. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Our email address, forum@kqed.org. And our website is kqed.org/forum. And click on this segment. You also bring in Kierkegaard. We were throwing out a lot of names here, but I was struck by just seeing a headline about your book, a very good review about your book in the Wall Street Journal, where they said, they quote Kierkegaard, was he a near comic dawdler, or did he have deep uncertainty like we all do about modern life? And that kind of gets at the heart of it too. I mean, one of the things perhaps that makes Hamlet such a multidimensional and rounded figure is just the extraordinary contradictoriness of Hamlet.
Yeah, sure.
Absolutely.
No, he is a contradiction. He lives a contradiction, the contradiction between the action he wants to perform and the thought which paralyzes it. And he is completely self-conscious of that. You know, so he is, Hamlet is divided against himself, and he knows perfectly well that he's divided against himself. He is, so he's a Kierkegaard-like figure in many ways. And he embodies, as it were, the virtues and the vices of that. I think it's,
In the, Thomas Carlyle, I think, in talking about Kierkegaard called the Valley of Indecision, that makes it almost euphemistically pleasant sounding. But for Hamlet, of course, it's nothing short of agony. Here's a listener who writes, I heard this couple on WNYC's Low Page show and immediately ordered the book. Hamlet is about Ophelia? Why not? The older I get, the more I think The Godfather is about Fredo and Kay Corleone. Hamlet had confounded me for decades until I tuned into Stanford's Literature of Crisis lecture series. The portrait of Hamlet as a man experiencing every form of crisis, personal, familial, political, religious, and a few others, makes the play deeply relevant. And a listener writes, how about looking at Hamlet through the Scarlet Letter? I'm not even sure what that means, but does that resonate for either of you or both of you?
I guess in terms of Gertrude, right, there's something about the woman who's marked. And at the book event that we did last night in the Bay Area, they were talking about staging Hamlet in prisons, and that the overriding theme, of course, was guilt and conscience, as you can imagine that the people in prison picked up on, but also the abandonment of the mother of the child. And certainly Gertrude is a sort of marked figure. And I guess also the Scarlet Woman.
Yeah.
Right. And we don't know. You know, the mother in many ways is the figure around whom the whole play rotates, and her, what does she want? And Hamlet cannot figure out what she wants. Does she want...
It's like Freud said, what do women want?
Right.
Well, yeah, but does she want? Does she want Claudius? And she went from... And if she wants Claudius, did she really love his father? And how did she go from Hyperion to a Satyr, from this man who was a real man, the father, to Claudius? And
who's
was she in on
the... King of Shreds and Patches.
Yeah, King of Shreds and Patches. And was she in on the murder? This is the question, which isn't really raised in the play, but it's there. You know, was she in on this?
It's palpable.
Yeah.
Speaking about plays being performed in prison, I think one of the earliest, you mentioned Godot earlier, one of the earliest performances of that play was in prison, and boy, did they get it, you know, right away in terms of the experiencing of the play.
And also Hamlet says the world is a prison, right? Denmark is a prison, then it's a goodly one, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern say, then is the world one. So for Hamlet, the world is a prison, and he's in a cell and completely conscious of that situation, and there's no escape for him.
And here's Neil, our first caller. Neil, welcome.
Yeah, a couple of points. First, what production of Hamlet that you've seen comes the closest to satisfying all of you in terms of what your interpretation is now? The second thing I'd like to point out is that a lot of critics like John Simon like to focus intensely on the credibility of the plot, but in terms of sheer police blotter, in terms of credibility, Hamlet is completely incredible. It could never have happened.
In terms of productions, the one that I saw the most satisfying recently was the Worcester Group. I just thought it was fantastic. They're sort of reinterpreting the Burton Hamlet. But what they did that I thought was so stunning was that they sort of mocked all the film versions of Hamlet throughout their production, in particular the very melodramatic moments that sort of destroy, the real quality of the play. So by doing that, they sort of stripped it back down to the sort of Hamlet that you want to see. And I think that we see our book that way, is trying to sort of push away the nostalgic sort of misty-eyed view of Hamlet and to get to what's really sort of weird about the play. And I felt that the Worcester Group was able to do that.
And also, it's a very good question. The second question is also very important. But I mean, we were asked by some friends to show a movie version of Hamlet, and we've got a huge pile at home. And we ended up choosing the Soviet Hamlet, which was directed by Kuznetsov, with in a translation by Pasternak and music by Shostakovich, because it's the most, as it were, the most unfamiliar kind of Hamlet. And it's also a very political Hamlet. And it's like, it's as if the Soviets looked at Olivier and said, we're going to do exactly the opposite to Olivier. We'll take this, as it were, tortured, fey, indecisive, psychological Hamlet, and we'll turn it into a political drama. That's a great production.
And every scene is full of people. So when he's doing his soliloquies, they're voiceovers, and he's in rooms full of people.
But it's also a real question about whether you can perform this play. It's a very, very long play.
It's a tough play to perform. And more language in it and more time in it than any other Shakespeare play, right? And let me thank Neil for the call and go right to another caller, and that's you. Ryan, good morning.
Good morning. I am a psychologist. Dr. Krasny actually delivered the graduation address at my graduate school many years ago. I love the idea of Polonius as the bad psychoanalyst, and I would even advance it further. He's a bad supervisor. He sort of lays out the frame of snack food's understanding of psychoanalysis.
He's also, now, forgive me, Ryan, he's also kind of a pimp, really, too.
Yes, he is.
Right. Well, you get some interns working for you, and you'll see how that goes. You also have this sort of developmental quality of the hypocrisy, an internalized hypocrisy creating this internal conflict. And when we want to feign madness and we have these internal conflicts to grasp, we don't have to pretend too much.
Mm-hmm. Yes, for you, Jameson.
I mean, the question of Hamlet's madness is fascinating, and we sort of zeroed in on Freud's very arrogant assertion in his unpublished paper on psychopathic characters on stage that the mystery of Hamlet was so deeply buried it was left to him to finally unearth it. There's something about the contradictions within Hamlet's character that are so ripe for psychological insight, and yet I love the fact that all these psychoanalysts have tried to tackle the play, and I don't think that they can fully tackle it. And that's the kind of, I think it's the knock at the arrogance of psychology.
I'm going to bring in my own biased view for a moment here.
Sure.
That is, the antic disposition is something that he's self-consciously aware of. And so there's a kind of posturing on the one hand, at the same time that he may be falling into a kind of madness. I mean, it's almost as if he's on the brink, really, isn't it?
He's acting out, but it's an acting out which really pushes things at times. He goes, particularly in the scene with the mother, he goes over into something else entirely. And one thing that we've left out is that if Polonius is the bad psychoanalyst, then there is a good psychoanalyst in the play, and the good psychoanalyst is the ghost.
Yeah.
And we look at the play in terms of the ghost as the analyst, which then raises the question. There is this tradition that Richard Burbage played Hamlet, as he played all of Shakespeare's lead roles, and there would be none of these plays were it not for Burbage's ability. But there is a tradition that suggests that Shakespeare played the ghost.
And we're very keen on what the ghost says when he speaks to Hamlet when he is in the throes of madness in the scene with his mother. The ghost says, "Do not forget, this visitation is but to whet thy almost blunted purpose. But look, amazement on thy mother sits. Oh, step between her and her fighting soul. Mm. Conceit in weakest body, strongest work. Speak to her, Hamlet." And we see that as the analyst asking him to speak, to really speak. And it's something that we think that he can't do.
It would be the first time, perhaps, in recorded history that a transference took place of a father with the dead father, if indeed it is the dead father. I mean, just taking that notion of transference and psychoanalysis. Mm-hmm. Here's a listener who writes, "What do you make of the original Hamlet story, Amlet, in Saxo Grammaticus's classic History of the Danish Kingdom? In that story, Amlet, A-M-L-E-T, is a real hero acting continually."
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, Hamlet, Shakespeare, you know, everything he did was based on sources. He was a great stealer of material in order to build it up, and that should tell us something about what art is. Art is theft. But it's not just that. Shakespeare will take that source material and the hero becomes something else. If Hamlet were a straightforward revenge drama and Hamlet were a kind of action hero, we wouldn't be discussing it at this point. it's because Shakespeare does something else with
Hamlet. What he does is he gives us some of the most lofty language that we've ever encountered.
Absolutely.
Extraordinary language, which is what keeps drawing us to the play more perhaps even than all of the characters and what's in them.
It's impossible to work on the language is so peculiar because you're working on, because everything you quote, and we quote a lot in the book, and we were intent on quoting as much as possible, everything feels like a cliche, everything feels familiar. So in a sense, it's trying to sort of defamiliarize that language, which is, because it's not just that Hamlet is a text, it's a text which is one of those texts which gives us the language that we speak.
Well, I could even tell when Jameson was reading before, I mean, there's a sense of being enamored of the language.
Yes.
Even though so much of the language has become commonplace, it's almost platitudinous to us now, even though it was original perhaps at the time. Jim writes, would your guest care to comment on John Updike's Gertrude and Claudius, his fictional prequel to the play?
We got that question last night. It's not one of the texts that we really go into. You know, our true hero in the book, I think, is Melville, and many people don't know, but his total failure of a romantic novel, Pierre the Ambiguities, is a redo of Hamlet. And I think he's one of the sort of more important figures, in particular because he says of his character that he cannot find any meaning in the hopeless gloom of the interior of this play. And he also can't draw from it those moral lessons that sort of are complacently drawn out of it. And he tears his copy of Hamlet and drops it
into 100 pieces and drops it on the floor. That's Melville.
That's Melville for you.
There was a biography of Melville called Melville's Quarrel with God. And in many ways, you know, that kind of gets us to the heart of what he was responding to there, I think. But let me go to another caller here, and that's Christina. Good morning.
Hi. If you are saying that, or if you're reading Polonius as the bad analyst and the Ghost is the good analyst, and Polonius as also kind of the head of surveillance, could we also see the ghost as a kind of spectral surveillance? And what does that mean? And how is the ghost of the father internalized so that we can look at another or think about another way of thinking about surveillance? And
yeah, that's good.
Hey, you know, I would think of the ghost kind of as the opposite of surveillance, in particular just its etherealness versus the sort of omnipresence, right, of the idea of being watched or surveilled. And, you know, we talk about Hamlet's self-surveillance in psychoanalytic terms in the idea of the superego, that we almost have a policeman inside of our own heads. And we were sort of hoping that with the ghost's injunction to speak, that it's a kind of dematerialization of that sort of policeman in our own heads.
Yeah, and the ghost surveys, but he surveys only for portions. And during the day, he's in the cleansing fires of purgatory. So he's watching at night. And also the thing which comes up in the play is that ghosts appear in times of preparation for war when something is wrong with the state. Right. So in a sense, there's a state of surveillance, a police state, which is Elsinore, and the ghost is a sign that something is really wrong.
And he says, "Leave your mother alone." Right, that's the injunction of the ghost to Hamlet. Leave her alone.
One of our producers, Amanda Stupai, wanted to know about you. You'd mentioned, I don't think it was the Webster Group. Is it Worcester Group?
Worcester Group.
Worcester Group. Yeah.
Worcester Group. The mighty Worcester Group.
And who are they?
They're a theatre group run by Elizabeth LeConte, which have been going since the early 70s in Worcester Street in Soho, and which, for my money, probably the best theatre group in the world. Not that I'm biased or anything.
There's a listener who says, I'm remembering a seminar back in 1990 at UC Berkeley after Angela Patton and Mark Rylance performed the chamber scene. Mr. Rylance became a member of the discussion panel. There was some preliminary give and take about the scene when suddenly Mark Rylance burst forth that this panel of Shakespeare scholars didn't even like Hamlet, the man, and that he found the discussion entirely exasperating. It's great to hear from people who do seem to like the man. Well, I would say maybe you're both ambivalent about the man, if I may.
I think we end one of the chapters, do we even like Hamlet, the man.
I like Mark Rylance a lot, and you know he was director. He was artistic director of the Globe for many years, and I watched him on many occasions just dominate the stage. He's an extraordinary stage actor, Mark Rylance, and he's someone that completely understands Shakespeare on the stage. So I think Hamlet is someone that invites our fascination, but also our ambivalence. I think that's maybe what a hero is, after all. Someone with whom we're drawn to them, but in a sense, we don't know what we're being drawn to. We're being drawn to something which is complex.
And wasn't it Freud who said that's the state of modern man, ambivalence? That's the key word to our human condition. Mm-hmm. An interesting question from a listener named Bob, and I'd be curious to know what you two would say to him. He says, I'm an engineer. I've never read Shakespeare. Should I? Would I understand it? What would it mean to understand Shakespeare?
It's a good question.
He should read. I mean, the one thing that we say about Shakespeare is that you should read him, and you should read him again and again and again, and you know, maybe even read him more than watch it on the stage, because it's sometimes really hard to grab the language and to let it speak to you and to be able to hear it when you're sort of watching it unfold before you. And we read this play so closely. I mean, that's what the book is. I mean, quote, I think, almost the entirety of the play within this very short
book. Well, you do something that's traditional in literary studies. We call it explicación de text. I mean, you get into the explication of the text, which is, you know, meat, butter and meat. It used to be, at least, for literature professors, certainly.
Yeah, things have changed a little bit, sadly. But let's not get into that. But I say to who called in about reading, is that, I mean, for me, my family didn't go to the theatre, didn't know what a theatre was. It was, for me, Shakespeare was something that came in partially through the eye, but also through the ear. I listened to recordings of plays on a Sony Walkman and when those things existed. And for me, so going to the theatre can be something with high cultural expectations. There's a kind of a lot of nonsense around theatre, and it's expensive. And
yes, but Simon, you know enough about the history to know that it was the rabble who went to see Shakespeare largely.
Yeah.
Shakespeare became very snobbish culturally years later.
But that's right.
It was what we would now call the proletariat who were mainly his audience.
The groundlings. And so in many ways, I think Shakespeare can speak to people that haven't read the plays and are not familiar with them in a way which I think is incredibly powerful. Once you get past all that kind of cultural nonsense about, you know, what Shakespeare means.
The book again, Stay Illusion, The Hamlet Doctrine, and you can join us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. And here's Nathan from Berkeley. Good morning.
Hi. There's something that I have encountered before in criticism. I've never seen anyone suggest that Hamlet isn't sure which of the two kings is really his father. And I don't know how much that would mean in terms of the play, but I think it's interesting that no one has explored that.
I mean, there's a question there. It's a question that people have raised as to whether maybe Gertrude and Claudius have been getting it on for quite some time. maybe Claudius is Hamlet's...
That's pre-modern language, getting it on.
Getting it on, yes, right.
He gets around.
Used to use the Bay Area idiom. Claudius is Hamlet's father. There is that. There's nowhere suggested in the play, but it does pop into one's mind.
As does so much with this play, which is part of the mystery and perhaps what calls one to the play and continues to call one to the play. Here's a listener who writes, I'd like to hear more of a defense of the claims that Hamlet is, one, melancholic, and two, delaying. These are largely 19th century interpretations that don't always hold up against the text.
Okay. Mm.
Wow. For me, Freud's essay Mourning and Melancholia holds up today. And I have... There's not another text for me that explains the phenomena of depression. And what's sort of fascinating about what he says is that in mourning, we have to sort of construct the object as lost. And it takes a long time. And it takes a very subjective amount of time. I will mourn my father a different length of time than you will mourn your father, but it's absolutely subjective. And he can't understand what is paralyzed in that creates melancholia. Why can't this working through of a loss take place? And when he looks at the two phenomena of regular mourning and melancholia or depression, if we wanted to put it in contemporary terms, he says that the difference between the two is that in melancholia or depression, you find a lot of ego. And he says, you know, for someone who feels so worthless and who feels this sort of like nihilistic apprehension of life, they don't seem to have a lot of shame and remorse. In fact, they make a huge nuisance of themselves, displaying their woundedness and their sense of the meaninglessness of life. And he says, this is what we have to understand in order to understand what is stalled. And, you know, as someone who works clinically with patients, this is 100% true.
But taking 19th century thinkers' ideas and applying them to Shakespearean plays or medieval plays or whatever, This is commonplace, really, in the world of analysis and what we do in interpretive
life. And the delay, I mean, on the delay, I'd say, well, you know, Jameson just quoted that passage from The Ghost where the ghost says this visitation is to whet thy almost blunted purpose. So the ghost accuses Hamlet of delay. And for me, the most poignant scene in the play is the scene, a plane in Denmark, when Hamlet is on his way to England and sees this army, and we get this Hamlet viewing this conflict between the Norwegians and the Poles, completely futile war over a scrap of land. And Hamlet goes into this soliloquy about the futility of war, and then says, "And now I will do it. You know, now I will do it." At which point he disappears for a boat to England, and he does delay. Eventually, he does kill the king, but only when he's already dead. he says three times, "I'm dead, Horatio. I'm dead, Horatio." It's only when he's poisoned that he can finally lunge out.
And after Laertes tells him the king's to blame, after he hears a truth he already knows from someone else's
mouth. He needs it confirmed, almost.
And he can't say it himself.
There's also that those words that always I hearken back to when I think of Hamlet, the pale cast of thought, you know, as if somehow
sicklied over with the pale cast of
that
thought.
Keeps you from action. It keeps you from the impelling need to act on whatever your impulses are or whatever you feel you need to act as a noble and righteous person. Here's Kelly, who writes, "Hamlet's To Be or Not To Be had a profound effect on me in high school. It literally saved my life when, during a time I was very suicidal and struggling with coming out in the early 90s, being gay wasn't an acceptable mainstream as it is today, especially in the Midwestern town that I grew up in. What I took from that speech at the age of 17 was that suicide wasn't the answer, because life after death could be worse than what I was living, and I just couldn't bear to take that chance, so I chose life."
The undiscovered country.
I remember a student once saying to me, "Hamlet could not be about suicide or the contemplation of suicide because Shakespeare had a Catholic worldview." And this is someone who had been, I guess, in another kind of nunnery than what we get in Hamlet, had been in parochial schools.
Before Hamlet sees the ghost, the first time we encounter him, he's contemplating suicide. And suicide for him is forbidden because the everlasting has fixed his canon against self-slaughter. So there is a sanction against suicide, but suicide is very much on Hamlet's mind. And people for whom there is no everlasting, you know, we were in Seattle a few days ago and we're thinking about Kurt Cobain, but one of Kurt Cobain's suicide notes was, you know, "Like Hamlet, I had to choose between life and death, I choose death." For Kurt Cobain, there was no everlasting. So in a sense, the question of suicide for Hamlet is a very, very real question.
And by the way, if you've just joined us, we're talking with Simon Critchley and Jameson Webster. They are co-authors, husband and wife, of Stay Illusion, The Hamlet Doctrine. So this book, writing this book, brought you even closer together, huh? It was good for the marriage.
Good for the marriage.
We recommend writing about Shakespeare in order to solidify one's married life.
Well, one of our listeners, by the way, an excerpt of your book is on our website, kqed.org.
Great.
And a listener wanted to remind us that a nunnery was a brothel as well as a nunnery, which I tried to allude to a little obliquely a minute ago. But here's Howard, who writes, "To me, Hamlet is about a young man with a bright future, a prince in love, suddenly burdened with a duty to take revenge, knowing he will destroy his family and his country in the process, caught between two opposing duties of filial piety and societal peace. Who would not be tortured by those conflicting obligations?"
Sure. Absolutely. I'd like to go back to something that one of the earlier callers said, which is about the, you know, Hamlet saving one's life. I take that very seriously, and also the question of Hamlet's identity, because one thing we look at in the book is that there was a fantastic 19th century interpretation. There's this book called The Mystery of Hamlet by Vining from 1881. And the mystery of Hamlet is solved for Vining because Hamlet is a woman. Hamlet is a woman. And that explains
its appearance in Joyce as well, when Bloom goes by the theater and he says Sandra Bernhardt had played Hamlet as a woman. And he says, maybe why Ophelia killed herself.
And so Hamlet is someone with gender trouble, as they say in the Bay Area. He's someone, you know, with for whom his masculinity or his femininity, these things are very much in question. And the Olivier Hamlet, famously, is a kind of, how would you put that?
How much do you accept that notion that Hamlet may indeed be of a different gender.
I think it's interesting because what it led to was in the late 19th century, early 20th century, was a whole fashion for women playing Hamlet. Women playing this lead role. Sarah Bernhardt played Hamlet. And why not?
There have been reams and reams of all kinds of discourse written about, you know, gender studies in Hamlet. In Shakespeare in general, because of the fact that boys were playing women and
absolutely
all of these costumes and so forth, which give us all sorts of multiple transgender identities.
We can say, one thing we can say for sure is that theatre is queer. Theatre is a little bit queer, or more than a little bit queer.
I think Harold Bloom said on this program, the only thing we know about Shakespeare really is that where he was born and that he was bisexual. And where Bloom came to that conclusion, I'm not sure, but he said it with, like, it was incontrovertible, beyond
any
shadow of a doubt.
If Harold Bloom says it, it must be true.
Well, what's the next work for you two? You're going to do another Shakespeare play and create even more intimacy between you?
We're thinking about it. We're also pondering the possibility of writing something actually about suicide notes, which is something we're thinking about. But we're going to see how this goes for a while, right?
It's true. There's this great book by Mark Etkind called Or Not to Be, where he did this amazing study of suicide notes. And a lot of what we had gone into in the book, in the psychoanalytic and philosophical sections, you see sort of in action in these notes. I mean, they're harrowing to read. But in particular, the idea that the suicide note arises at the point where propaganda and newspapers come into being.
I think the best suicide note that I have ever read, I must tell you, you know the name W.J. Cash, the psychohistorian who wrote The Mind of the South? He said, "I can't stand it anymore, and I don't even know what it is." Yeah. I mean, that's one that stays with you, I think. As does your book. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you very much.
So
pleasant to have you both here, and good luck with the future, whatever it brings. Again, the book is Stay Illusion, The Hamlet Doctrine by Jameson Webster, who's a psychoanalyst in private practice in New York and professor at Eugene Lane College, and Simon Critchley, Hans Jonas, professor of philosophy at the New School. And again, we have an excerpt on our website, so avail yourself of that, kqed.org/forum. Are you two going to be appearing anywhere else in the Bay Area? Or?
No, we're done now.
We're done now.
Good. Then onward and upward. And thank you again for joining us. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Larberg, and Amanda Stupaya is our engagement producer. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Our senior editor, Dan Zoll. Our engineer, Danny Bringer. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.